Robert, welcome to Eye on the Arts.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Especially good to have you in to talk about the man they refer to as the master of Broadway, Stephen Sondheim, celebrating his 80th birthday tomorrow. When did the name Stephen Sondheim first come into your line of sight?
I think, like most people in my generation, that would have been in the 1970s when Judy Collins had a big hit with Sand in the Clowns from A Little Night Music. And I heard that. I think I must have heard Comedy Tonight without being aware of who wrote it. But in addition to Judy Collins' version, I got to know Cleo Lane's from her 1973 Carnegie Hall concert album. And at that time, I had no idea what the story of A Little Night Music was, and I didn't really know much about Sondheim. I hadn't really gotten to know West Side Story even very well. And so the song was very haunting and beautiful, but I had absolutely no idea what the lyrics meant. And so I guess a few years later, I was living in Vancouver, and I used to play and work with a bunch of the Vancouver-based actor-singers. And they had at that time a little sort of restaurant cabaret called Sophie's in Gastown.
Okay.
And we would put on little shows. And it was then that I was introduced to songs like Side by Side by Side from Company. Mm-hmm. And people began to tell me what they were about in the context of the show. And so at that point, I was very, very interested in this man. I would in some ways call him not only the master, but a little bit the enfant terrible, even if he is turning 80 tomorrow.
Yeah, true. Very true. My first experience with Sondheim was probably the same thing, hearing Judy Collins do Send in the Clowns, because there were thousands of recordings of Send in the Clowns. Sondheim himself, and I mentioned this on the show a few weeks ago on the anniversary of Follies opening on, or of Night Music opening on Broadway, that Sondheim actually wrote it for Glynis Johns, who couldn't sing.
Yes.
And he came in one day at rehearsal with this tune and said, I don't know, it sounds like something you'd hear in a cocktail lounge, which of course is ultimately what it became. It became his hit.
Absolutely.
And the fact that it was written originally for somebody who couldn't sing, and so he wrote it with words that ended with consonants, hard endings, like, isn't it rich? Don't you approve? And he always thought that singers never did it justice.
Well, I remember seeing him give a masterclass in England. One of my friends sang something, I believe, from Sweeney Todd, and it was amazing how he went after the relishing of final consonants beginning and the next word, like "Don't you love farce?" was something he went over and over with the singer. So it is true. I would say that I think the song does benefit from a fine singer, and that referring to singers who are somewhat careless with their final consonants is an indictment we can level against singers of any repertoire,
well,
you know, because it is
true.
Essential. I remember that song, Send in the Clowns, was given an absolutely fantastic emotional performance from Dame Judi Dench in the 90s.
Yes, I believe it. I believe it. Because, of course, she started out as a musical theater
she
performer.
She did plenty, yes,
she
indeed.
She was supposed to be, well, she was Sally Bowles, I believe, the original Sally Bowles
in London.
Many people don't, and was supposed to play Grisabella in the original production of Cats, but broke her ankle.
Or severed a tendon or something horrible.
The musical theater performer's worst nightmare, especially when you end up losing out on a role that introduces a song like Memory. Yeah. Ironic and interesting, and we can get to this later, the fact that Stephen Sondheim shares a birthday with Andrew Lloyd Webber. We can talk.
Well, they
about
are
that
kind of the Twin Peaks.
Yeah,
or they
are.
They
yeah,
were for a long time.
Yeah. But just to get back to just share my first experience with the music of Stephen Sondheim, after Send in the Clowns, about a year later, I was living in Winnipeg, and I did a kind of cooperative semi-professional production of Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And I think, like you, I already knew the show somehow. I may have seen it at some point, but even still didn't really know who this guy Sondheim was. I thought the music was very clever. The lyrics certainly very, very clever.
Absolutely.
Very witty. And about a year later, I did an outdoor theater in Winnipeg. Rainbow Stage is kind of a legendary theater, and somebody should write a book about that place. Maybe I will one day. Anyway, I was doing a production of My Fair Lady, and it was my first kind of professional production, fully professional production, and the new artistic director of the Manitoba Theater Center, Len Carreyrou, was playing Henry Higgins. And, you know, we hit it off and worked together and enjoyed working together. And then in December, I think it was December of that year, he called me and asked me if I would like to do a role in Company, which he was doing at MTC the next month. And I ended up giving up my day job, which was being a DJ, but in order to do it. So Company became my very first full-time professional job.
Well, that's an excellent way to start.
No kidding.
Mine was, in terms of being music director, yeah, actually took place at UVic, at the Phoenix Theater, in the mid-90s, 96. I was asked to be music director for a production of Merrily We Roll Along, which, unlike Company, was one of Stephen Sondheim's flops on Broadway.
One of actually his many flops.
He had a few. Yes.
He had, you know, for a guy who is considered the master of Broadway, he had probably more flops than he did than he did successes.
Well, in that way, even his successes, I guess most famously Follies, which ran for over 700 performances, sure, still didn't recoup its cost, which in the days was quite considerable. But nevertheless, I mean, he didn't have the kind of long running hits that Rodgers and Hammerstein had, and certainly that Andrew Lloyd Webber did, but we still love him.
Yeah.
Merrily and Anyone Can Whistle, I guess, are the two that ran for only about 7 or 9 performances.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so they decided to do it at UVic because I guess they felt it was an ideal vehicle for, undergrads.
And well, for Merrily, especially because it's bunch of kids.
Yes, and that actually gave introduced me to Sondheim in terms of the entire show, and I really began to sink my teeth into the repertoire, although some of his most popular songs, or certainly some of the ones I like the most, were dropped. They were sort of left on the side of the road in out-of-town tryouts. But it's been a long journey getting to know all of the shows, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's that's where I think it's the interesting comparison between Sondheim and Andrew Lloyd Webber, is that Sondheim's shows, I don't think Sweeney Todd ever made money.
It didn't make much. I remember seeing Angela Lansbury on TV in an interview saying, you know, they took that thing out on the road, and it was so expensive because of this massive set.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
she said that it finally, when they began winning those Tonys, that began drawing people into the theater to see it. And it's difficult for younger audience members today because we think of it as such a great classic, and it's revived usually very successfully, but it took a while.
The unfortunate thing is I never got to see Len Cariou play Sweeney Todd.
No, and that's one of my regrets, is that when they put out the DVD, which has the immortal Angela Lansbury performance, it's with George Hearn, who's wonderful, but I still wish they'd managed to capture that original cast.
Yeah, it is too bad. especially because I was working with Len when he got the call.
Oh, that would have been
tendered
exciting.
Tendered his resignation, I've told this story on the show before, that it was announced in the paper, and we were in rehearsals. I think we were doing Of Mice and Men together. He was directing, and I walked into rehearsal that day and said, "Len, why are you leaving?" Because he'd only been there half a season at that point. And he said, "Well, I got a call from Hal Prince. He wants me to come down and do Stephen Sondheim's latest musical." And I said, "Well, what's it about?" And he said, "Well, it's about a guy who cuts people up and turns them into meat pies." And I said, "Well, that's a stupid idea for a musical. It'll never succeed."
Weren't the only person who thought so, I'm sure.
Nevertheless, it did become a big hit for a while, and as you say, won all the Tonys. Let's hear a little of Sweeney Todd.
"And we have some shepherds, five peppered with actual shepherd on top. And I've just begun. He's a politician, so oily, inside with a doily of one.
Put it on a bun. Well, you never know if it's going to run.
Tell a flyer, fry the dryer.
No, the clergy is really too coarse and too mealy.
An actor that's compactor.
Yes, and always arrives overdone.
There it is, Stephen Sondheim's Priest, a little priest, as Angela Lansbury and Len Cariou trade ideas about what to put in the meat pies.
A wonderful number. And as Angela Lansbury said, really difficult. That the whole score is very, very challenging for the performers. Yeah.
And I really, when I was cast in Company, didn't really know who this guy was. Had no idea of what he was, who he was. I had to go out and get the original cast recording in order to listen to it, and I thought, wow, This is interesting.
It is interesting. And yeah. and that show in particular was quite groundbreaking. I would put it in the top five or six of musicals that really opened new doors. The idea of a plotless musical kind of presenting a series of events in the lives of these people that are being focused on rather than having a linear kind of storytelling was really, really interesting.
Like many of Sondheim's shows, they were groundbreaking and different. And just for those who may not know Company, I'm going to play a little bit of the opening number from Company, from the original production.
Bobby, dear, it's none of my business. Darling, you've been looking peculiar. Bobby, then your name came up only last night. Say it is fun, Bobby, we've been worried.
The opening number is everybody is calling out to the central character, Bobby, his good and crazy people, his married friends, as he calls them.
The sort of central concept of a 35-year-old man living this sort of urban, sophisticated life in New York City, but being afraid of commitment, is it still resonates when you see it. I went to see the revival on Broadway in 2006 with this now immortal or sort of legendary performance in the central role by Raul Esparza. And I remember I liked it so much, I went back to my hotel, phoned Ticketmaster, bought a seat for the next night and saw it two nights running. And the second night, I was sitting in a row behind none other than Judy Collins herself.
Oh, no
her husband. And I remember she was very taken with this performance as well. I didn't chat with her or anything, but she was very obviously enchanted by the show and particularly by this great performance as Bobby.
Now, wasn't that the production where the actors also played the instruments?
Yes, John Doyle's direction. It was the second.
The second one.
The first was Sweeney Todd.
A remake of Sweeney Todd.
That was with Patti LuPone. And I saw that one as well. And that didn't work for me the way I know a lot of people liked it. I didn't find that worked as well. In Company, I felt the story being more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think perhaps the instruments that the actors happened to be able to play were more complementary to the... And perhaps they played them a little bit better. But in any case, it worked just fine.
This has become a trend now and is popping up quite frequently, not just on Broadway, but in theaters all over the place, the idea of the actors playing the instruments themselves. And I think economies have a lot to do with that. I think they figure, theaters figure they can save a lot of money if the actors play the instruments themselves. Because they
I guess
don't have to hire an orchestra.
We'll now have to start calling them quadruple threats.
Yes, exactly.
It's something's lost a little bit,
I
feel the same way about the trend towards using synthesizers and very mm-hmm. heavily reduced orchestras. I just a few months ago saw the current revival of Little Night Music, which stars Catherine Zeta-Jones and again Angela Lansbury, and that's a very very lush score meant to evoke a sort of fin de siècle kind of era, and they've reduced it to seven players, and it doesn't work in my opinion. I know Sondheim says that he's okay with it. I think in private he probably isn't.
Yeah,
because that beautiful score with its lush, rich textures is just lost a little bit.
Well, why don't we hear a little bit of the original?
But one name that should be mentioned in the context of the sounds of the orchestra is that of Jonathan Tunick, who does most of the orchestrations for Sondheim's shows, and he's a genius. Where he evokes the most beautiful colors, and he is given a fair bit of information from Sondheim himself. Sondheim will give him inner lines for that are meant to be heard in the orchestra, and then he'll choose the instruments.
Yeah.
I know some Broadway composers will only give the orchestrator the tune, so a lot of those songs are more like collaborations than compositions being orchestrated by another person. But Jonathan Tunick has done exemplary work as both an orchestrator and a composer, and for that matter, a conductor.
Do you think Stephen Sondheim's place in musical theater history of the 20th century as the master, as one of the greats, do you think it's deserved?
Oh, without question it is. He is without question one of the greats, and he has brought a unique sensibility to musical theater in both his tunes, which are, I think, quite beautiful. I know he's sometimes, I think, unjustly maligned for not writing singable tunes, but they are. They're just sometimes a little more complex and unexpected, but also for his incredible fusion of very intelligent, sophisticated lyrics and mm-hmm. absolutely appropriate music. So yes, I think his future is without question assured. I would hesitate to call him the master simply because I think this form has a place for many masters. And I think in the American canon anyway, there are several who I think will emerge as leaders.
It's interesting in his later career, and Stephen hasn't written anything new for some time. I know, I think on the occasion of his 70th birthday, he essentially disavowed himself of any further connection with Broadway because he said it had become a theme park and didn't want to be involved. But his musicals were moving so far away from anything that most people would be able to understand musically. I mean, you think of Pacific Overtures.
Absolutely.
One of the first really, really challenging musicals, and from Sondheim, and I've got a little sample of that.
I am no nightingale, but she hears the song. I can sing to her, my lady wife. I am no nightingale, but my song.
Set in Japan, using the pentatonic scale, Sondheim challenging his audience.
And still unmistakably Sondheim.
Yes, absolutely.
But as a lot of the times they bring the works back. I mean, Sondheim is quite frequently revived on mm-hmm. Broadway, and it's kind of like seeing a new show because it's still challenging.
Yes.
Mind you, that's true of any great work of theater. It can survive different interpretations and speak to successive generations of audience goers.
I did a production of Passion, which is probably his most challenging
yes.
musical. I did it probably about 10 years ago, and it was a pretty awful production, mainly because the director was in way in over his head, but that's a whole other story. This was in Toronto, and for anybody who hasn't heard the score of Passion, Sondheim decided to write a musical based on the 12-tone scale, where you use all 12 notes in the scale before you repeat them.
Yes.
So frequently it becomes very unmelodic.
Well, it does. Again, I found that it repays close listening. And if you listen closely and concentrate, and also if you listen to it more than once. I didn't have a chance to see that ever live, but I remember it was televised, the production with Maren Mazzi and the great Donna Murphy.
Yes,
and
it certainly, that was the original.
Yes, it certainly benefits from deeply committed performers like that.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
I kind of like that show. It's
really,
you have to be in the right mood for Passion. Otherwise, you feel like you've been in a sort of hothouse for 90 minutes.
Well, not only is the music challenging, but I always thought the story was pretty challenging about not only a woman who was homely, I think is the best way to describe her, but who also has a passion for this handsome guy, verging on obsession.
I think it becomes obsession. She's essentially a stalker.
Yeah, and she makes him crazy, but then he ends up falling in love with her, and quite frankly, I never bought that concept. But then halfway through the second act of Passion, it was almost like Stephen got bored with experimenting with 12-tone and started writing some glorious melodies again.
Absolutely, there's some keepers in that.
Last I see what comes from feeling loved. Strange how merely feeling loved, you see things clearly, things I feared, like the world itself, I now love dearly. I want to live, now I want to live,
just from being.
That is Donna Murphy, and I can't remember the male lead's name, but a beautiful, beautiful, glorious, lush melody, Sondheim at his absolute finest.
You know, that show, if you look at the lyrics, many, many people over the years have said that Sondheim writes lyrics that are so fantastic for every situation except an honest, straightforward love story. There aren't that very many love songs in his canon. And it's think we find some very nice but relatively simple love lyrics in Passion.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe he finally got to a place in his own life where he could write a simple love story.
Perhaps, but yeah. I think it's a lovely show. I'd love to see someone do it, and it could be done in a small, relatively intimate space, maybe seating 900 or so.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's the size of the theater that I played it in.
Perfect.
And it was with a chamber orchestra, yes. So it was about 12 pieces,
yeah,
I think.
Chamber orchestra, yeah. Not synthesized.
No, it was all acoustic. It was a beautiful, lovely orchestra. Again, the conductor had a very flowery style of conducting. I couldn't find his downbeat to save my life. The one time I tried to follow him, I came in a bar early on one of the on the finale.
Let that serve as a warning to all, yes, aspiring singers.
Exactly. Yes, and conductors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least give us the downbeat. Your favorite Sondheim show?
Well, that's difficult. So I'm going to give you a long-winded answer, I'm afraid.
Please do. We have time.
I would say I'm going to divide them into two categories to get this first one over with. That Sondheim, of course, contributed lyrics to other people's music.
Yes, true.
At least three times in the sort of main stage kind of way. And the most famous of these, I guess, is probably still West Side Story. But I have to say, for me, Gypsy is the towering thing, the work that he... he collaborated with Jules Tine, mm-hmm, and to me that's the great, great, great work of Sondheim as a lyricist only.
Certainly. He originally was going to do both music and lyrics.
And Ethel Merman didn't want to gamble on a relatively unknown composer.
Yeah, she just had a bad experience, mm-hmm, with an unknown composer, and she said,
yes,
no.
Yes, and then Sondheim turned to his great mentor, Oscar Hammerstein, for advice, and Hammerstein said, because he'd already been a little bit burnt because he only got to write the lyrics for West Side Story, and
right,
he was ready to move on, but Hammerstein said, no, you have a chance to work with Merman, work with her, and I think he probably learned a lot. But as for my other favorites, I would say, as a score, as a collection of songs, it's pretty hard to beat Follies. There's just something for everybody, and because the book is relatively thin on the ground for that show, you experience the revelations of the characters in the music and in the lyrics.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, a wonderful score with, again, lush orchestrations. And yet, I also have a great, tremendous fondness for Into the Woods, which, mm-hmm, I do sympathize with the people who point out that it is quite long and it stagnates a little bit in the second act. But I find it essentially a very humane work that's represented in the lyrics and the music as well.
Into the Woods is actually the only Sondheim show I've seen on Broadway.
I haven't seen it on Broadway.
I saw the original production with Bernadette Peters and
Joanna Gleason.
And Joanna Gleason, yes, and loved it. It was great. I hear what you're saying about it being a little... kind of losing its way partway through the
second
act.
I didn't mind it. I do sympathize with people who found themselves getting a little bit restless. But on the whole, I think it takes this theme. What it does is combine different fairy tales so that collectively they have a happy ending at the end of the,
yes,
first act. And then we examine what happens when they interfere with each other, and we look at the unhappy possibilities in the second act. And I actually found it very moving.
But getting back to Follies, because I think I have to agree with you, and it's an interesting case of a score that is vastly superior to the book. And I think the book is more challenging, and certainly when it first came out in the 70s, the name Follies gave traditional Broadway goers a feeling that they were going to go and see a Ziegfeld Follies.
And they saw the decayed version.
They saw exactly what happened to those people 20 or 30 years later, and decaying relationships. And some astonishing numbers in it, and probably the best version. The 1985, I think,
Follies in Concert.
Follies in Concert is, to me, the definitive version.
The opportunities to see Follies are few and far between.
They
just
are.
Simply because it needs stars, and it's an expensive show. But you have Carol Burnett.
Black Sable one day, next day it goes into hock. But I'm here. Top billing Monday, Tuesday you're touring in stock. But I'm here. Then your career
So that's I'm Still Here, the great anthem to aging, and sung by a character named Carlotta in Follies. And that's been performed, of course, by many legends like Ann Miller in the Paper Mill production and in the original Yvonne DiCarlo, who by all accounts had trouble remembering the words. And
that's unfortunate with Sondheim, when you've got a line like, career to career. That's Sondheim.
Breathtaking.
Yeah.
And moviegoers might remember Shirley MacLaine singing a version that Sondheim wrote particularly for that movie she made with Meryl Streep, Postcards from the Edge.
Oh, yes.
And I heard a snatch of it sung by Debbie Reynolds in one of her one-woman shows.
Right.
A little bit. And the original song that was dropped on the road or in the previews that was going to be sung in place of I'm Still Here is a really funny song called Can That Boy Foxtrot. Maybe we'll play a little bit of that later.
Why don't we play it now?
Okay. This is a version just with piano, and it gives you an idea, again, of his incredible wit when he writes a comic novel.
I know this grocery clerk, unprepossessing. Some think the boy's a jerk, they have my blessing. But when he starts to move, he aims to please, which only goes to prove that sometimes in a clerk you find a Hercules. He hasn't much that's plus, you might describe him thus: a false alarm, a broken arm, an imitation Hitler ran with littler charm. But oh, can that boy foxtrot? His mouth is mean.
I knew the song, but I didn't realize it originally came from Follies.
Yes, it did. And what a line, an imitation Hitler but with littler charm. Yeah. Which I could have written that.
Sondheim at his finest. Getting back to the Follies in Concert version, one of the other numbers, Broadway Baby, which is sung frequently by young girls in auditions. I can't tell you the number of auditions I've sung through or sat through with young girls, sweet young things doing their first audition singing I'm Just a Broadway Baby.
But it's supposed to be a sort of old has-been, really.
Yeah, and the quintessential version is from that 85 concert, and we'll just hear a couple of seconds of it.
I'm just a Broadway baby, walking off my tired feet, pounding 42nd Street to be in a show. Oh.
The incomparable Elaine Stritch.
Who is, right as we speak, preparing to appear yet again at the Cafe Carlyle, which is where she lives.
She literally lives there.
Yeah, so she can just go downstairs and do a few numbers. She's the one and only Elaine Stritch.
Yeah, saw her in Toronto do her one-woman show a few years ago.
At Liberty.
At Liberty.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, I love the, actually in the program, under the bios, under her name, it said, if you actually pay attention to the show, a bio in this case is redundant.
Yes, and you can't help but pay attention. I only have the CDs of it, and it's transfixing even without her physical presence. Yeah. So it must have been just a great experience.
Oh, it was. It was. And she let it all hang out. So would you consider Stephen Sondheim the most influential composer of the 20th century?
Of Broadway musicals?
Yeah, of Broadway musicals.
It's hard to know. I went to see a show called The Light in the Piazza, which was by the son of his very good friend, Mary Rogers.
Adam Gettle.
Yes, yeah. Richard Rogers' grandson. And many people said that it was a Sondheim-esque kind of score.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the show very much and found that this was a young man writing very much in his own personal voice. Mm-hmm. And I guess I resented it a little bit that people used the idea that this was a relatively tuneless score to identify it as having Sondheim characteristics. I just can't get by that. Jerry Herman, when he won the Tony for La Cage aux Folles, thanked the audience and the Tony voters by saying, it's nice to know that you still like an old-fashioned tuneful show. I don't get it, because to me, Sondheim's tunes are as hummable as anybody else's. They're beautiful. They touch you. But in any case, this Light in the Piazza is at least one example of a show by a composer who has been identified as something of a Sondheim follower, perhaps. But I think it's still a little early to say how he'll influence audiences to go, because as you said, Broadway's turning into kind of a theme park. So,
theme park.
You know, he was working in an era where it was much more possible to do experimental work than it currently is.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see. But as I said, I think he's not the only master. And when the dust settles, I wouldn't be surprised if the great quartet of musicals given to us by Rodgers and Hammerstein won't be right at the top of the mountain. And I say that quartet because Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, and King and I are the ones that I think are going to endure. I think there's just something a little bit too sugary about Sound of Music. It's sort of a seasonal piece.
Yes.
Whereas the others, you can bring them out. I saw the revival that's currently at Lincoln Center of South Pacific 3 times.
Mm.
I was overwhelmed by how much that speaks directly to the audience even today. And it was a masterful revival. They didn't spare anything. They had a 30-piece orchestra. And
oh, good.
You should walk to New York just to hear it.
Okay.
Because they were good players and they loved the score, obviously. But they didn't change a word of the dialogue or the lyrics. And Hammerstein, being a mentor and close friend of Sondheim's,
yes,
was never in his league in terms of this sort of intellectual sophistication of the lyrics. But boy, are they ever heartfelt and genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And you believe that the lyrics would be sung only by that character. There's nothing artificial about them. So I think that is really the most enduring quality of the great musicals, is how honest they are, how direct they are, and how sincere they are about presenting their characters, no matter how complicated.
Getting back to Sondheim and Hammerstein, an interesting juxtaposition. Hammerstein, the cockeyed optimist, as he mm-hmm. called himself, and I think that was his autobiography.
Probably.
Was
that sounds right.
Called that. And Sondheim, who was often accused of being overly clever with his lyrics to the point of being completely dispassionate.
Yes, and he has actually leveled that criticism against himself in interviews. It's interesting, that relationship, isn't it? Because he was aware of Oscar Hammerstein's limitations. I think he loved him very deeply as a kind of father figure and mm-hmm. mentor and advisor. Sondheim had a very difficult relationship with an extremely unstable mother.
Yes.
So the Hammersteins really provided him with a warm and loving sort of nucleus. And he said of that famous songwriting team that Hammerstein was a man of limited talent but unlimited soul, and Rodgers was a man of unlimited talent but limited soul. And they worked together, actually, Rodgers and Sondheim. I don't think it was a very easy working relationship.
Yeah, well, I can see their personality. From what I've read about both their personalities, I can see them not necessarily getting along.
Yeah, sort of like two porcupines.
Yeah, kind of. Robert, this has been fascinating. I thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
To celebrate the birthday of certainly one of, if not the master,
absolutely,
of the second part of the 20th century.
Yes, it will be interesting to see. These shows are becoming more and more popular. They're becoming more and more embedded in our culture, as difficult as some of them may have been when they've opened.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, Sondheim's not going anywhere.